Hello and welcome to, well, I'll still call it the preview show, but it's more like the review show. So it's the off season, and to entertain you over the winter, we've decided that we're going to do some rider recaps of the year. So I am delighted that we're joined by Matteo Jorgensen today of Movistar. Matteo, how are you?
Good, good. It's a pleasure, David.
So where are you in the world just now?
I'm in Nice, at my apartment. Nice, France. Cool.
Lovely. Right, we're going to jump straight back into the start of 2021. So if you can remember that far back, what was your winter training like? How did it go?
Yeah, I went really well. I think a little bit too well. I was quite serious about like making the year a lot better after COVID and having a good year. So I trained really hard. I had a big December already, was quite focused and was doing good quality work the whole time. So already at training camp in January, I was in good form, I could tell. And I was kind of just hoping that I would just like go to another level after that and keep going through the spring and maybe like get to new heights. But I think looking back, it was probably a bit too much.
So you were starting your second season at Movistar. Did you set yourself any particular goals at the start of the year? Are you that type of rider?
Yeah. I set a goal, a pretty important one. I wanted to win a race. Doesn't matter what race, doesn't matter what level. I wanted to like win one race. So that was my objective through the whole year. Didn't quite happen, but I did want to be up there fighting for the win at least and try to win a race.
Okay. Did you start thinking you had anything to prove? Your first year went well, but in your head, did you think, I've got something to prove here?
That's a good question. I think not too much. I really just wanted to continue like showing my worth a little bit. I don't think my first season went so well that I already had big expectations or anything like that. No, I would say I was more in a headspace of like still wanting to, raise the expectations for the future, you know, like still show what I'm capable of.
So you started in Provence. First big stage was a climb up to Chalet-Renard and you finished 12th. That day, Ineos set the crazy pace from the bottom to the top. Souza won. You hung on. A long time. I mean, you are, 1 meter, 90 centimeters? Is that accurate?
Yes, that's accurate. So,
and you are approximately, probably between 5 to 10 kilograms heavier than some of the tiny little mountain climbers.
Then they could do one a bit more than that even.
Okay, so to hang on and finish 12th was pretty exceptional, I think. And I think a lot of people took notice at that point of you, and what an incredible start to the season. So what do you remember of that stage?
Yeah, I remember we had Enrique was at the race with us, and they were, Enrique didn't really want to he wasn't like firing quite yet. It was super early for him, so he didn't want to go hard. And in the bus in the morning, they were like, we just, Matteo, like the coaches have said you're in good form. So we're just going to ride for you and have you do the climb. And I had no idea really. I had no expectation of that, but I remember like really trying to give it my all and like the whole day, think about the climb as if I was a climber and do it like a mountaintop finish proper, where kind of the whole day you're just trying to conserve as much as you can. And it was big fight into the bottom and really hard climb. I think like the start is so hard that I went well over threshold, which for me, like, it's a bit like, I guess I'm the type of rider that really like knows my limits and is always thinking in my head like how to pace things. So it's always a good experience to like start a climb like way too hard for yourself, you know, like do way more than you know you should be able to do for that length of climb. And I was on just such a good day and I was in such good form that I was able to do that pace for way longer than I had ever before. And I think I like set I think I probably set a power record on that climb. So it was just a good mental thing for me to know like okay, if it feels really hard and it feels like maybe I can't do the pace like on some of these climbs in the future, maybe just try it and try to hang on instead of like sitting back and doing your own pace. So it's good learning.
How far did you get up the climb before you were dropped? Do you remember?
Yeah. I remember I got to like those big rocks. There's like some big rocks that come up on the side of the road and it gets super steep, a couple switchbacks. And right there, I think it's the steepest part of the climb, maybe second steepest at the beginning. But yeah, I remember going like around a switchback. And I think Sosa attacked at that exact moment when I was getting dropped. And I was looking and I was like, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. Quite a few big names had already been dropped. Like,
yeah,
I don't know if this is a done thing, but when you're riding and you see guys, I think Lutsenko was one of them who actually started the stage as one of the big favorites. Mm-hmm. When you see guys like that getting dropped, are you like, oh man, what am I doing? Or is it, do you feel anything? Do you notice it?
Yeah, no, you do. Oh, I notice it. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think at that point in my head, I was seeing it and it was definitely encouraging me a little bit, but it was still February. In the back of my head, I was like, oh, these guys probably don't care about this race at all, you know, but it definitely helps in your head, I think.
And did you take any confidence out of that performance?
Yeah, no, I did. Definitely. Having done the numbers and also just, yeah, having done a stage like that where I'm up with guys, I think I finished with Barguil and guys that I respect a lot and are good climbers. So it definitely gave me a lot of confidence and helps like me and Perry Nice, definitely.
How does it feel being the team leader? You mentioned there, Enric Mas, I mean, a guy with a glittering palmares, when he turns around and says to you, yeah, it's your shot today. I mean, that must feel pretty incredible.
Yeah. It's something that I never really imagined happening when I was young, even. I never expected to be in that sort of role. So yeah, it's pretty special and kind of like, you don't even really, I don't think, grasp how big of a opportunity it is until you like look back and you realize like, because in it, you're so focused on like performing well, but afterwards you kind of realize like, oh, that's crazy, you know?
So then you head to Paris Nice. So kind of your home race, finishing down in Nice. You go there as team leader, proper big world tour race, and you walk away eighth place, which was a pretty stunning result. Yeah?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I don't think it's anything like super flashy, but for me, it was, yeah, definitely like my biggest result ever in my life. And pretty special to me. I've watched the race a long, long time, and it's part of the reason that race is part of the reason that I decided to move to Nice when I was coming to Europe and I went pro. So yeah, it was pretty cool. And after like racing up some of these roads and yeah, just racing in a lot of, I was kind of the whole race just thinking about like what it looks like on TV. And I just remember watching the race, how epic it was. Like you start up in Paris and it's rainy or windy or whatever, and then you come down and you get into the mountains and it's sunny. And yeah, it was just a pretty epic thing to be thinking about that. And then also be like fighting up there, like towards the end of the stages in the final with those big guys. And yeah, it was a cool experience and kind of shifted my mindset a little bit. And yeah, it was pretty big for me personally.
Your good GC was based around a pretty solid time trial. You finished about 30 seconds down on Bissinger and Cavagna, who won that day. It was a flat TT. That was, for me, not a surprise, but I think it's the first time I've seen you go that well in a time trial.
Yeah. I surprised myself a little bit too. I think generally my engine is like, it should be good at time trials. I'm kind of that type of rider where I have like a really just good aerobic engine. But for me, the big limiter in time trials is like my body shape. I'm just really not aerodynamic and I'm also not optimized at all. I haven't done really any work on trying to get myself aero. And so, yeah, I always try to do my best performance in TTs, even if like there's no, I'm way down in GC or I just think every TT you do, it's a bit of a learning experience. So yeah, at that Paris Nice, I think it was actually a good TT. I don't think like the result was good. I think it was like probably in the 20th or 25th or something. But yeah, I think it was a good performance. And like it also showed me like maybe you don't have to be like if you want to do GC in these smaller races, you don't have to like have a winning any stage. You don't have to like win the TT or win anything, because if you just are solid every day and you don't like lose time at any moment, you can be, you know, up there when you get to the end and the last few decisive stages. So yeah.
And so we've spoken before, you've got wide shoulders. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're trying to get aero for the TT, everybody talks about as narrow as you possibly can at the front. So yeah. Is that the kind of the main issue, I think, stopping you from being as aero possibly as some others?
I think so. I mean, I haven't done any testing, like I said. So all I see is big numbers on my computer and a really slow speed compared to everyone else. But no.
Do you need to get into the wind tunnel?
Yeah, I need to get in the wind tunnel or on the track or something. But I think it's mostly my shoulders. When I look at pictures, it's like, it's ridiculous. I just need to find a way somehow to pull them out of the wind to kind of, yeah, I need to do some exercises or something.
I look forward to some aerodynamicist coming up with a bizarre looking position where you're kind of hunched around or something like that.
Yeah, I've always joked that I could just take out my collarbones. So kind of like a redundant bone in the body. You can just take them out and don't really need them.
At Paris-Nice, we had obviously Roglic, who didn't go on to win the race because he was crashing the final stage, but we had Roglic, who was on a different level compared to everybody else.
Yeah.
And you weren't too far away from that kind of main group of like your Tiesch Benoots, your Vlasovs, your Shackmans. Again, you've left Provence with confidence from the climb in Châtelet-Renard. You must have left Paris-Nice thinking, I'm not too far away from these guys.
Yeah, I think it was all within context for me. I had looked at the course like that winter, that early winter already, when they were telling me like, oh, you're going to do the race. And it was like, yeah, it was like a really, there was only basically one climbing day. And so for me, that kind of, that showed me, yeah, that maybe I could do it, because those middle days, like that Rhone Alps day, I forgot where I finished, at Chirub or something. Those kind of days I think I'm pretty solid at. It's like when they're shorter climbs, not super steep most of them, and kind of just up and down, I think I can perform well. But it's when you get like an hour long climb or two back-to-back long climbs, I think I suffer pretty bad just with my weight. So I think, yeah, I wasn't that far off those guys, but I think if the course was slightly different, it probably would have pulled those differences a bit out more. Like even if there's just one other mountaintop finish, or even if the last day had been what it was planned to be, like the real knee stage, who knows how it would have gone. But I think, yeah, I think the differences would have been a bit bigger. But no, it definitely gave me confidence that, like, you know, these guys aren't so far away. You know, they're also older than me, and given a few years, you know, maybe I could be around there. So it gave me confidence for sure.
Then we go to Giro. So first Grand Tour. The Giro is a beautiful race. I'm sure you've watched it on TV.
Yeah.
You're going there to support Marc Soler. What was your feelings kind of leading up to that race? You know, you travel over, you land in Italy, probably Tuesday, Wednesday, or whatever it was. Was it excitement, nerves? You know, how were you feeling?
Yeah, I was nervous. I kind of knew where I was at physically already beforehand. And I had gone to Sierra Nevada to a training camp. Basically, like, I did Paris-Nice, did this small race in Italy, Coppi Bartali, like the week after. And immediately after Coppi Bartali, I went altitude. And I was already feeling pretty cooked in Coppi Bartali like the week after Paris-Nice, and then went straight to altitude with the team, went to Sierra Nevada, and was kind of just the whole time like on a level where I wasn't performing terribly, but I wasn't gaining anything from the altitude. That like I wasn't really improving at all, and I was just like feeling every day kind of the same sensation. It's like even if I took two rest days, the next day I would still feel like pretty cooked. And I was still like functional enough. So it was like hard to tell, you know, where I was at. And going into the Giro, like if you're anywhere, at least at my age and not having done a Grand Tour, I think if you're anywhere like under fresh, it's probably not good. You know, if you have any fatigue at all, it's probably not good. And I was trying to kind of convince myself that it'd be fine. And we took like a bunch of days super easy before the Giro to kind of do some last minute freshening up. But in the back of my head, I definitely knew, like where my body was at, and I could feel that tiredness. So I felt pretty nervous for the race, and I kind of was just expecting it to go not so great already. Instead of like being optimistic, in my head, I was overthinking it already. So yeah, it wasn't the greatest start, I think.
Did I remember right? You picked up an illness as well during the race.
Yeah, that as well. I think like after 3 days, I was coughing, and yeah, it wasn't good to have that in COVID either, because everyone's super worried. You're taking tests left and right, but yeah, I got something, and I had like probably 3 nights with a fever in the middle week of the race, which wasn't good either. Kind of like the fact that I was tired too, and my body was already down, it just drew out the sickness. So I kind of was sick like for the majority of the race, some sort of just like low level sickness where, yeah, I was just every day in the group just suffering. Yeah.
How hard is that mentally? Obviously, you go to, and I've spoken to a number of cyclists who have experienced something similar. They go to a grand tour and it's just not going for whatever reason. And it seems to be massively draining mentally just to get up every day and put yourself through that pain to be riding about in the gruppetto. How hard is it?
Yeah, it was really like, the thing was, is that like at my age, it's like pretty normal to be in the gruppetto and stuff. And it's just like, so from the team's perspective, it's like, okay, it's like not a big deal. He's like, you know, he's just having a bad race. But in my head, like the whole spring was kind of like leading upwards, and I was like hoping to do better and better, and kind of like just constantly like thinking, okay, this race will put me at another level, and then like another level. And then to kind of just see, like, I took a big break like with racing. So I didn't race for a while, and I did the Ardennes, and I was kind of realizing like, oh, I'm not going so well. And then to do the Giro, when you race, just like you race every day back to back. And like, if you're at a bad level, it's not like it's going to change. You know that there's like 15 more stages in front of you where you're going to be just getting pounded by the same guys. You know what I mean? It's like, it's so hard mentally to know kind of like how long is in front of you, and how, like, you know, if you're tired at the beginning, it's like there's just 2 more weeks to get more tired. It's not going to like, you're not going to like freshen up or come around at the end, at least at my age. Maybe the older guys would, but yeah. So it's just kind of like a negative spiral, and you just like start to think like, oh, maybe I'm just not ever going to be good at like this grand tour thing, you know? And you kind of start to forget the context, and like, you forget that, oh, you came in already tired. And yeah, you just start to, cause you're racing against the same guys. It's like, these guys are dropping you every day, and you start to realize, okay, well, maybe that guy's just better. You know, like maybe that group, I'm just not really supposed to be in that group. It's like 7 days of climbing and they've dropped me every time. It's like, well, I guess c'est la vie, you know? But yeah, I think afterwards with some context, you start to think back and you're like, okay, yeah, I think I was just cooked. It's just as simple as that.
A large dose of imposter syndrome for 3 weeks.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So how long does it actually feel? I know, obviously, it's a 3-week race. The longest you've done before is a week. You know, when, obviously, 3 weeks of suffering, does it feel like an eternity?
Yeah, it felt really long. I remember, like, somewhere in the middle, maybe towards the end of the second week, I was talking, my roommate was Dario Cataldo. So he's a guy who's done like, you know, I don't know how many grand tours, but a lot of them. He was like 35 or in that range where he's done a ton. And he's like, wow, this race has gone by fast. And I was just thinking to myself, like, no, it has not at all. Like, this has been the longest 2 weeks of my life, you know? Like, it's like before the stage, you're trying to like analyze every, at least, you know, my personality is I'm looking at the stage and I'm like spending a bunch of mental energy in the bus, like looking at the stage, trying to figure out, okay, I need to hang on till here because the gruppetto is not going to start until this climb. And if I get dropped here, I'm going to be alone the whole day. So it's like, you just spend so much energy worrying about the race, and then you do the race and that probably doesn't go so well. So afterwards you're thinking about it. And that just draws it out so much, I think. I think if it's going bad, the Grand Tour probably feels way longer than if it's going well. Because if it's going well, you kind of just at night you sit back and you're like, ah, tomorrow, you know, I'm going well and I'll probably be better tomorrow. So yeah.
Then the team kind of changed dynamics. Soler left the race kind of midway through. Then it was breakaway stages. The team were hunting. The team did pretty well at getting into the breakaways. Didn't quite manage to get the win. I think you popped up. Was it stage 20?
Yeah.
You managed to get in the break.
Yeah.
So right last second, well, last stage where you can get in the break, and there you go. And then all of a sudden, the main group decide to chase you down.
Yeah. I've never experienced, I guess, what I mean. I think it happens to pretty much every rider where they come into a Grand Tour, and maybe there's some teams that do it from the start, but once you lose your leader, it's like there's literally no other tactic but like the whole team in the break. So every morning in the meeting, it's just like everyone for the break. Like we all just need to get in the break. And so it's kind of like it's just a strange thing where when you don't have any other goal in the race, it's like if you don't make the break, then the whole rest of the day you're just kind of twiddling your thumbs. You're just like waiting for the next day. But yeah, I think it was good to kind of see how to actually get in the breaks. You know, like I have never done that as so much where, you know, you kind of see at what time of the race the break starts to form and like, you know, what are the signs in the group that the break's going to go? Like you can kind of sense when guys are getting tired and now you should start trying. And it took me a while to figure it out, obviously. And I never made the breakaway until, yeah, I think I made it on stage 18 as well or something. And then again on stage 20. And yeah, stage 20, I got in it. And then we hit the first climb and it was like the longest climb in the race. I think it was like 25K at whatever. I just went backwards from the peloton from the breakaway through the peloton. There's like a leaders group and then there was like a second group of guys that I was thinking, oh, hang on to these guys, got dropped from them, went straight to the gruppetto. It was just a hard race, and that day was probably the hardest of the whole thing. It was ridiculous.
How empty did you feel at the end of the 3 weeks?
Really empty. Yeah. I didn't do myself any favors because I still like went full gas in the time trial. They had the whole team kind of, or at least my teammates, like the experienced ones, were like, you don't need to go full gas. Like it'll take you way longer to recover from this race if you go full gas in the deep. In my head from the start, I was already thinking I'm going to do it. So yeah, I went super deep in the TT, and then I just remember we finished and they had bought pizzas for us. And I think I literally to myself, I ate three like full size pizzas in Milan or wherever it was. And yeah, I mean, it was ridiculous. After that, I spent like a week sleeping 10 hours a night, 11 hours a night. I was empty.
How long off the bike did you take after it?
Not that long. I had agreed with the team to do this gravel race they wanted me to do a week after in Kansas. So yeah, I didn't spend that long off the bike. I only had like 4 days off. And then on like the Friday before the race, I had to go for a ride I mean, it was like a 200 or 300K gravel race. So it was like, yeah, definitely not what I should have agreed to, but yeah.
1 week after your first Grand Tour.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was terrible. I remember I was like, I got off the plane there and I was in like the Canyon house. I was staying with like all the Canyon athletes and Stetna was like, man, you look inflamed. And I'm like, yeah, no doubt. My face was like round and I was just inflamed all over. Yeah, it was bad, but I did like half the race and flatted out. I got like 5 flats. So thankfully I didn't have to do the whole thing.
How hard was it you then came back? I think it was the Spanish races. You did some 1 day races before Deutschland Tour. How hard is it to restart?
Yeah, thankfully I had a big amount of time. Like I had the whole summer almost, or like I had all of June and all of July to kind of reset. So I started training back pretty slowly and I didn't have to worry about racing at all until, yeah, the Spanish races, the team basically said, because the tour was going on. So the team was like, the first race you could possibly do is like late July. So I just, yeah, started back slowly and thankfully had a bit of a disconnect from racing and was able to kind of train myself back to racing slowly. And it wasn't that bad. It felt like, you know, coming back in the winter or something, those first races back in the winter, which usually when you're a young guy go well because you come into form quick and yeah, it's usually okay. So they were quite fun.
So then Tour de Britain, you lose time. The team had a poor team time trial. You then drop some more time deliberately to try and free yourself up to get in the breaks.
Yeah.
We see you're very active. It was one of the races in British TV we see from the start to the finish. It's all broadcast live. So very, very active a number of days. And then my home stage, you get in the break with, unfortunately, two Quickstep riders who both had a very fast sprint on them. And you finished second in Edinburgh. So how was that stage for you?
Yeah, that stage was great. I it was the day before that I really thought the break would make it. It felt like the stage was well suited to the break. So the day before, in my head, I was like, okay, it's break or nothing. You know, like I need to be in every move after the first 15 minutes and I need to make sure I'm in it. And I missed it. And then the break didn't work that day. So the next day I was like pretty cooked from that day, to be honest. Then I went for it again at the end of that stage. So I was pretty cooked. And the DS was like, we don't even need to be in the break today. It's going to be a sprint. We should just back and like just race. And so I didn't even kind of in my head think I was going to be in the break. And then at the start, it was like pretty fast for a good 20, 30 minutes before we even got to the hills. And it was like really lined out and there wasn't very much organization from any team at the front. So I kind of just decided in the middle of the race that I'm going to try to get in the break. And yeah, I got in it. And then it was not a bad break. It was pretty good. Other than having two quick step, it was like a perfect composition. And we went all the way to the line. I mean, there wasn't much to it. They just let us go. And we didn't ride super hard the whole day, which was nice. And I remember towards the end, I kept asking, we had Max Siandri in the car and I was like, Max, cause I didn't look at the stage at all. I like didn't really pay attention beforehand to really how the stage looked. And I was like, Max, I need you to tell me what the end of the stage looks like. And I'm like, just tell me like tell me it in 5K chunks. And he kind of like walked me through it and told me like the different hills there were, and there just wasn't much. I mean, the stage was pretty like middle loaded with hills. It had like a bunch of these longer climbs in the middle of the stage. And then at the end, it was like mostly flat or, you know, low gradient climbs. So I didn't see any, Max and I both didn't see any place where we could get rid of these two quick step really. But I had to try. So I went, I think, 3 or 4 times and on different moments where, you know, either like Ballerini was pulling off the front after kind of like a hard turn or whatever. And it just wasn't working. I mean, those two guys have an incredible jump. They're both great sprinters. So, you know, to jump onto an attack, it's the same effort, you know, they're both really good at it. So to actually do it, you either have to have a climb to like gas them out a little bit or catch them by surprise, which was really tough. They just weren't letting me get behind them. So like Lampard would sit up as I was drifting back so that I would always stay in front of him and Ballerini the same thing. So yeah, I was just like, oh, these guys are playing me. And they were. And eventually Lampard actually made the decisive move after I think one of my moves. And then yeah, we went to the line and I mean, I tried a sprint. I did my best. I didn't do bad numbers for myself. I did like a good sprint, reasonably good, but I wasn't even close. I didn't even like get to his back wheel. You know what I mean? I didn't even overlap at all. I was just in his draft all the way to the line, which was, yeah, a bit mentally like, shit, you know, how much, you know, how am I going to make that up? I, like, yeah, it's like, how am I going to improve my sprint that much? I don't know, but I think it was just the circumstances of being against two really good sprinters in the end.
Yeah, and when Lampard gets in a break, Lampard usually wins.
He's just so good at it.
So you had some, for an American rider being in Scotland, you had some unusual support. So you went past my house with 10 kilometers to go, and my wife and a young child were shouting your name. If you heard that, and then
did you think
that was weird?
I thought I heard two or three people shouting my name through the race, and each time I was like, that's super strange, that's never happened before. Yeah,
and then you go directly past me, positioned perfectly outside the pub, which was just, that was wonderful planning by us who were watching the race to go right past and then unfortunately you had to leave straight after the race. And you missed out on Iron Brew.
That sucks. Disappointing. Yeah, that was a big disappointment. My biggest of the season, to be honest.
I had to break through the cordon to get onto the team bus.
Oh, really?
And then the driver, and I think maybe the DS, who were talking away in Spanish, looked quite surprised when they saw me approach them with a bag of goodies. But you weren't there, so they didn't get any.
That's a shame.
It was all too quick step.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Well, that sucks. Yeah, I had to leave right after. I don't remember why, but yeah.
So you did the Worlds. You know, obviously that would be pretty big achievement just to race a World Championship, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was cool. I mean, it was good to do my first Pro One. They asked me originally to do the U23 race, and I don't know how I feel about that. I'm not a big fan of racing down like that. I've always... Whenever I was U23 and I raced Worlds and saw those guys, you know, the World Tour guys racing down, I was just like, well, I mean, they just don't have the same opportunity, you know. It's like they don't, if the under 23 guys can't race a Grand Tour or can't do the same like level of races through the season, then they shouldn't be allowed to race the Worlds together, because it's just an unfair playing field in my opinion. So yeah, it was good to do the pro race and kind of see where the level was at, which was really high, obviously.
And then you go to Roubaix.
Yeah.
A nice, lovely day for you to get out and enjoy your first Paris-Roubaix. What was that like?
Yeah, it was cool. They gave it to me last minute. I was maybe like going to go to the Italian races. And yeah, at Worlds, they basically told me like, oh no, we're going to send you to Roubaix. So I was like, okay. It's a good way to end the season with a broken collarbone. That's in my head what I was thinking. I was like, oh, great. I should probably cancel my vacation plans because I'm going to have a broken collarbone or something. But no, once I saw the rain, I was kind of a little bit more like optimistic about it. I like the rain. I go well usually. So I was like, okay, maybe, you know, I could actually do something and it's not just going to be like a, you know, day in the Gruppetto. And yeah, I was able to get in the break and go through some of the sectors and just live the wildness that is Roubaix. It was a fun race, I guess. I don't know. In the dry, I think it's totally different. I think in my head, it's a different race than what it really usually is, because I think usually you get on the cobbles and, you know, the differences between like someone my size and someone, I don't know, Sagan size are big. And I think I didn't really get to experience that because it was a bit more technical this year. But yeah, I don't know if I'd like to do it again. If it's in the rain, maybe.
Yeah, usually isn't in the rain though, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
So off season, fans who watch the sport assume that riders will improve year on year. You know, it's just like, okay, so this year Matteo does, you know, the Giro, and next year he'll come back. He's got a Grand Tour on his legs and he will be challenging to win not a number of races, because riders just improve year on, year out, because that's what happens. How hard is it to even go about improving? Like you have improved from like last year, 2020 to 2021, you are better, okay? You're older, you've got a bigger engine.
Yeah.
Is it simply that? Is it simply, you know, you've got more racing kilometers in the legs? Is it as easy as that to say that that will then make you better, or is it stuff you do in training?
Yeah, I think it's mostly brought on just by, yeah, my age. And every year, like, I'm just, my body's developing a bit more. I think I was like late to the, like, my body's just a bit late to develop. So I'm like, I still maybe in like 2019 still look like, you know, a 17-year-old kid. But I think every year my body's changing a bit. And I think up to this point, I've just been kind of riding that wave of like physical development. And yeah, your training evolves along with that. So like every year I'm able to, my body can handle more training. Like I can do a, you know, a big 30-hour week and now and kind of like absorb it and afterwards feel ready to go again sooner. But yeah, eventually that will stop. And in my head, I'm always kind of wondering like when. I don't think I'm at that point yet at all. I think like my body is actually still kind of developing, and every year like my appearance changes a little bit. And I think those are all signs that maybe I'm not quite done developing. But yeah, it's kind of always in the back of my head, like, when is that going to stop? And, you know, like, you're kind of always like guessing a little bit how hard you can train, how much you can push it without going too far. And like, you're kind of just guessing what your body can handle. So yeah, I'm definitely hoping that this year, having a full, you know, a full race calendar and, you know, my only year, probably over 30 race days. I had double my second biggest season this year. So I'm hoping that will, you know, push some physiological changes into next year, but you never really know.
What does the winter look like for you? Are you going back to America?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll stay here in Nice for November. I would just like to start my training in a place where the weather's good and I know it's going to be, it's like solid training. So I'll stay here in November, and then like kind of probably December-ish or Thanksgiving time, I'll go back to the States and spend the holidays with my family and maybe go to California for a bit. But yeah, I think I'll spend most of November here. And I signed up for a French class. So yeah, hopefully I can get my French to like a really good fluent level. I took a placement test and they placed me, I think, too high. I'm in like the highest level of French. So I'm a bit worried. It's going to be full gas here for a month of like the morning going to class and then afternoon training. So should be okay.
What does training look like for you? Obviously it's November tomorrow. Is it very easy? Is it distance? What does training look like in the off season?
Yeah, I start tomorrow. I just got my plan. We were just at camp, so I just got my like first couple of weeks of training, like into the training peaks, and yeah, they're wanting to like correct what happened last year and make sure I don't arrive in January already at like race weight and already at full form. So we're gonna spend like 2 weeks still kind of like losing, slowly declining in fitness, but like just doing other activities. So like running and like riding every day, but. Like low volume and pretty easy, and then adding like, you know, high level or high amounts of like gym work and some running. I've done a couple runs now for the first time in my life, so yeah, just doing some fun things and doing some other kind of cross training sports to kind of make sure I don't get into form too soon.
Come on then, what's your minutes per kilometer? Are you five? Well, are you 5 minute kilometers or are you under?
Well, last night I did 20 minutes at 4:30. So that was pretty ripping. But literally that was the third run of my life. It's not a joke at all. Maybe when I was a kid, I ran the mile like in middle school or something, but yeah, I wake up every morning a bit screwed. My legs are pretty not used to it, but hopefully they'll adapt.
Speaking of somebody who is now stuck on a solid 6 minutes per kilometer.
Oh,
nice. I hate going onto Strava at this point and seeing all the athletes, all the cyclists out running like 4 minute kilometers for 10K. it's soul destroying, but you know,
oh, really?
That's okay. Right. So we started the year thinking about what type of rider you could become. And you said before in a previous interview about trying different things to kind of try and work out what you might be. Yeah. Are you any further forward in working out the type of rider you will become?
Yeah, I think I'm a little farther forward. I think I'm starting to kind of rule things out and like I don't think at my current height, I'm never going to be really like a Grand Tour GC contender or, you know, a pure climber. So I think I'm starting to realize like where my limits are. I don't think I'll ever do like an hour at 7 a kilo or something up a climb. But I think I'm also starting to realize that a big part of like some of these leaders and how like how they chose what they're good at is like what they're passionate about doing. And like at the end of the day, you have to like to go full gas into something and to be like one of these top guys, you have to really be passionate about whatever like aspect you choose. So if you go the GC route, you have to really like want to do it. And it's a real grind in those races. I saw from the Giro, like those guys really suffer every day. And, you know, like they're just as tired as you in the second week, but they have to do, you know, like their best performances ever. And, you know, day by day by day, back to back. So I think I'm starting to realize that I need to like this next year kind of figure out what I really enjoy racing and which races like really give me that, that feeling like, oh, this is what I want to do. But yeah, I still haven't done like all the classics yet. So I'd like to this season, try to do like a full spring block, hopefully if the team allows me to, and kind of see what they really are and see if that's what I want to do. But, you know, I'm starting to also this year, I really saw that like these guys that go for stage wins and the breakaway, I think that's a pretty cool thing that not enough guys like specialize in, you know, like there's a lot of guys that could do really well if they just like decided to like put GC to the side and just like go all in for stages and try that like full gas. And I think, yeah, it's something that, you know, maybe I'll look into and try to do.
There's a theory during the rounds that Tiege Benoot, that type of rider, is where some people see you kind of going towards. I think you like bad weather.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. The Belgian classics obviously are kind of screaming out a little bit.
Yeah.
You're quite tall. You've got big broad shoulders. So, you know, if you see guys, you mentioned them, Sagan, riders like that who are very good at holding position. Something I have noticed is that when you ride like stage races, you finish very high in sprint stages. So you're nearly always kind of top 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's that about? Is that, do you just enjoy that kind of side to it? Or?
I do, yeah. I just enjoy like the fight for position a little bit. And sometimes even if I don't need to, I just like get stuck into the final of races when like, in my mind, I know I'm not going to win a sprint, but it's just like a fun thing and a fun exercise to just like get stuck in and try to like hold position and be up there just for practice sake, if anything. But yeah, I definitely think just being a big rider, I mean, you have an advantage naturally. Like my roommate here, Will, he's super small. And I can imagine like in the group, you just get chopped left and right because your bars are just underneath other guys. And yeah, so I think I have a natural advantage, but no, I do like the whole positioning aspect. So it leans a bit towards classics.
I think we've settled it, really, to be fair. I mean,
hey, we'll see. We'll see. I don't want
to give the team a phone. Just tell them. Well, Matteo, thank you for giving up your time today. I hope you have a nice, relaxing off season. And I look forward to seeing what you do in 2022. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David.